Shrink Wrap Radio number 756, Active Imagination Adventures After Brain Surgery with Jungian analyst Michael Gellert.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Los Angeles-based Jungian analyst Michael Gellert. We'll be discussing his 2021 book, Far From This Land, a memoir about evolution, love, and the afterlife, which describes a vivid inner world which opened up after brain surgery. Now, here's the interview. Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
It's good to have you back. You know, this is not your first time here. We were just reviewing. How many times has it been? We figured out it's been two other books that we discussed here, your two previous books. And now you've got yet another book that's just been released, and it's called Far From This Land, a memoir about evolution, love, and the afterlife. I love the way you bite off these little topics, these little simple topics.
Yeah. Each can use a book on their own.
Yeah, really, really. And and this book is very different from your earlier ones, though each one was distinctive in its own right. This one describes a vivid inner world that opened up to you as a result of brain surgery. And you shared that that you actually wrote the book 15 years ago, and you've kind of been sitting on it. So it's taken you 15 years to publish this book. What's up with that?
Interesting question. When I wrote it, I did send it off to someone to look at it in the publishing world. And the person got back to me and said they enjoyed the book, but they wouldn't know where to begin in terms of selling it and marketing it.
Uh-huh.
So I just, I agreed with him. And I was a little ambivalent about publishing it myself. For a number of reasons. But in the last 14, 15 years, there's been some interesting developments in our culture.
Yeah.
Most notably, Jung's publication of the Red Book.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Also in literature and in film, there were movies that exemplified some of the principles that the book highlights.
Yeah.
So I thought that, you know, now there's a place for it in the culture. And I had a dream one night that I was in a room having a kind of luncheon with one of my publishers and her staff. And I woke up from that and immediately knew that that's the publisher to bring the book to. And she responded in a week or so. She liked the book and took it. Whereas one of my earlier books with Nicholas Hayes, they took a year and a half to get back to me. So I figured it was all a good omen. And that's how the 14 years, 15 years wait between the writing and the publishing came about.
Yeah. Now, your book is very much about active imagination. So maybe you can give us a quick take. I mean, you go into the history of active imagination in the book quite deeply, but just to give people an introduction here, because the book really hinges on that.
Sure. Active imagination is a concept that Jung named as such, although, as he himself admits, he didn't invent it or discover it. He discovered it in his own life as something that could help him. But it goes all the way back to ancient times. We know that Augustine, for example, and Goethe and Dante, and in the film world, Ingmar Bergman and Coleridge and the other romantics, a host of people used active imagination as a way to engage the unconscious and to reap the rewards of the wisdom of the unconscious.
Yeah.
So it's not exactly the same as novel writing or fiction. It's based on authentic experience, but it reads like a novel because it often, particularly in the case of Dante with the Divine Comedy, it's an adventure. It's an adventure of consciousness.
Okay.
The way it works, in a word, one would focus in awake on a character in a dream, not necessarily having to be from a dream. It can come through intuition as well, but often our unconscious in our dream sends us illuminating portraits with interesting people in them. And it's very hard often to get a sense of which part of our personality is being projected into that person in the dream, particularly if they're anonymous or, in the case of many of these authors, another celebrity. Dante, for example, discovered the presence of Virgil, the philosopher, ancient philosopher in his inner life, and he appears as a central character in the Divine Comedy. So the way one would do it is, if they have such a character come up in their dreams, they would carry the dream on from where it left off.
Mm-hmm.
And they would imagine themselves sinking into a sinking into the unconscious in a relaxed way. They would discover that they could talk to this figure, and the figure would talk back to them, often in a very autonomous way, independent of our everyday thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Very surprising.
Yeah, that's a key feature that we want to get into. Let me kick it off and get us into it, because the book starts off with a very interesting twist, because you're the guy ostensibly who's writing the book, and yet initially the book is narrated not by you, but by what you refer to as an alter ego, in other words, one of these inner figures named Richard, who is an atheistic professor of evolutionary psychology, not you, who has been recently had brain surgery, which in fact you did have, but he's had brain surgery and decides to consult a Jungian analyst by the name of Michael Gellert, who he's heard is good with dreams. So this is a fascinating way to begin the book. And maybe you can pick up the tale from there of the surgery and what transpired in its wake. The book goes into lots of detail. You're going to have to kind of take us through the high points, I think, of any other subpersonalities that emerged, etc.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, I think that also surprised me in the early active imagination process that this character, Richard, basically hijacked the story what actually happened to me and made it his own. I thought, well, maybe this character needs to be by me, by the ego, the dream ego as well, the I in my dreams needs to confront him and tell him to back off. It's not his story. But it turned out that he has been there all along, and he's been underneath my waking consciousness. And I figured that better to let him in and let him have his way, because with these autonomous personalities, these independent forces in our own psyches that come not only from our personal conscious and not even mostly necessarily from our personal unconscious, but comes from the collective unconscious.
Yeah, I want to underscore the autonomous quality. In other words, you have no sense that you're making this up, that you're consciously making it up. Rather, you have a sense, correct me if I'm wrong, you have a sense that there is an independent narrator in your mind that seems to exist outside your conscious volition.
Yeah, that's a good description.
Okay.
Nietzsche, for example, wrote Thus Spake Zarathustra, and as Jung suggested, it was an act of imagination. And Zarathustra took on a personality of his own, different than Nietzsche's in some ways, and also a projection of Nietzsche in other ways.
Let me bring you back to your story.
Sure.
You had brain surgery, and so did this inner character have brain surgery.
Right. Well,
Tell us about the brain surgery and what was your experience?
Well, when anybody like a doctor tells you with the MRIs up on his wall that you have a problem and a serious problem, and it may require him opening up my head and going into it, naturally this is, you know, shock and alarming and brings up all our basic human frailty, our mortality.
Yeah.
I of course, was more concerned with how I would survive this, more concerned with that than with dying, because you know, the mind is so central to everything we do in every day of our lives.
Yeah.
And if there would be some impairment, which the doctor said, you know, when you open up the brain and you just breathe on these very sensitive, delicate nerves, it could cause one of them to get paralyzed for a good year. The nerve gets paralyzed. So that was alarming, of course. And the assault on how I would be after, you know, like many people, I felt rather than have a serious mental impairment, I think that's in some ways worse than death. So it really brought me into a confrontation with my mortality and
And particularly because your whole career is based on, you know, the life of the mind.
Sorry.
And, you know, you're a Jungian analyst, you've written books, you're thinking about things all the time. People consult you for your ideas and input. And so that your whole personhood was at risk there. Big risk, big time.
So
what happened? They did it.
Well,
you wake up. What happens?
Well, in the period following that, I worked with my dreams, and this fellow Richard emerged early on and decided that he wanted to write this memoir. I figured better to let him in the front door than push him away or oppress him, because when we do that often with these archetypal autonomous forces within ourselves, they sneak around the house and they break in through the back door.
Yeah.
And then you are really, you know, gripped by them.
Yeah.
So he captures a small part of me that occasionally comes up, particularly around the notion of life after death or the continuity of our consciousness after we die.
Yeah.
And he represents, as you said, this kind of atheistic, very scientifically oriented approach to the psyche. He himself is a psychologist as well, but he's in a different school of psychology than I'm in. He's in this school of evolutionary psychology, psychology that is concerned with the evolution of our species and the development of our consciousness. So in two ways, I would say the book is also very much a memoir, not only of my personal history with this episode in my life, but with active imagination, because of these personalities came up. He's not the only autonomous complex in uh-huh. the series of dreams and visions that I had. And by visions, I mean the state you fall into when you do active imagination, because it's quite transformative. And very likely the kinds of visions the mystics and seers have had through all the ages, it comes from some ego work and dialogue while one is awake, and one falls into a kind of trance-like state, and the story continues as if it were a dream. Uh-huh. In fact, Jung treated active imagination as a continuance of the dream.
Yeah.
So he captured the part of me that, was skeptical about what happens after we die, and was debating throughout the entire story, how could this experience be happening? Because it eventually led him into a very fertile encounter with the living possibility that our consciousness does succeed our expectations and does continue. Jung made an interesting observation about that. He felt that he had absolute conviction that the psyche continues after we die. But his question was, for how long? for how long? And what would cause it to diminish, or what would cause it to become another kind of personality or become part of this collective phenomenon? On an energy level, this collective phenomenon we call the cosmos. So the story is very much about Richard's transformation from an atheistic position to one that is a more tolerant and open to the possibility of a kind of existence that thrives outside of our waking consciousness. In a sense, the journey to consciousness and the nature of consciousness is very much almost like a character in the story. It drives it forward, and it's very much what the story is about.
Yeah. What have you learned from this experience?
Well, I think I have a stronger conviction that things are not what they appear to be.
Yeah,
and
right.
There are things which do not appear at all. And this is why there's such a gulf between science and religion. It's because science bases its findings on observable data that can be, in an experiment, often repeated. Whereas religious experience or contact with life after death, or even the more typical synchronicities that and precognitive experiences that people, most people have had, these are not measurable or by science easily. And they're not easy, certainly, to repeat in an experiment. They kind of happen spontaneously.
Yeah.
Which is why most of these accounts are by word of mouth and not by, method that you can just pick up.
Yeah, I've struggled with that same basic question of and it's the synchronicities in my life, and I went through a period of just incredible synchronicities that has persuaded me that there's something more going on, because I sometimes refer to graduate school that I went to, the Academy of Doubt. in psychology, in traditional psychology, you're taught to be skeptical of everything. And so that's, you know, that's something the needle moves back and forth for me. And sometimes I need some kind of an experience to be, you know, I can get way over on the skeptical side, and then maybe I'll have a synchronistic experience or something else that'll swing it back a bit. Was that also for you, consciously, something that you, the conscious part of you struggled with and that somehow got manifested in this experience?
Curiously, that part of our experiences that you're describing, like synchronicity and precognitive episodes, and even, you know, UFO sightings and the crop circle sightings that people have had. Some people have seen these crop circles forming in front of their eyes. So in those cases, there's no doubt that these are really happening. The doubt is, what do they mean and where are they coming from?
Yeah.
That doubt you describe, I have had, of course, as well. In Zen, which I think, as you know, I've been a student of for 40 years now, they call it the great doubt. The great doubt that there is something deeper inside of us that is who we really are in our essences, and who we become when we go into death. In some ways, we go into death almost every night when we go unconscious and things happen out of our control. The dream world is a kind of underworld. The one area, though, that unlike synchronicities and those other kinds of experiences I had doubt in, is are the... certainly before this book, I had encounters with, in dreams and in waking consciousness, with you know, the living force of deceased people whom I love and who were important in my life. So I knew something was going on. But you see, even those experiences, one can explain them as phenomena of the psyche.
Yeah.
They seem very real, and they are real because the psyche is real and it can produce these events. It can even produce events that have a material effect. Jung gives the famous anecdote of when he was voyaging across the ocean to give lectures in America with Freud. They had a lot of conversation about this. And in one episode where Jung was visiting Freud at his home, Jung predicted that what he called an exteriorization catalytic phenomenon is going to happen now in 3 minutes. And he experienced forecast two of them in a row. And Freud, it happened. A loud retort came out of the bookshelf. And Jung writes that Freud looked at him aghast.
Yeah,
now, Freud eventually, towards the end of his life, came around to acknowledging these experiences as well, because if you're a student of the psyche, they're bound to happen. So I don't have too much doubt about those. But the question of life after death, is that something that the psyche produces, even the contacts with our deceased loved ones? There's no way of proving that other than our own experience.
Yeah.
And our experience must become the proof. And that is what, you know, the ancient Greeks called pistis, which is faith based on experience. It's not blind faith. It's a very discerning faith. But in the end of the day, only our experiences confirm what we're encountering.
That's fascinating. I did not know that the ancient Greeks had struggled with the same thing. Although they seem to have struggled with everything that we've struggled with. Yeah, they had a name.
And certainly the concern about, you know, the eternity or immortality of the soul goes all the way back to ancient times. It's a prevalent human concern. We are perhaps the only species on the planet that knows that we will die, and questions what will come after.
Yeah, yeah. So I asked you what you had learned from this set of experiences. Is there any way in which you are changed by what's happened, do you think, in terms of, yeah?
Well, if I was a avid student of the psychology of the unconscious mind before I wrote this, I'm certainly now even more impressed with how profound the human psyche is and what exploring it can lead to. You know, the Romantics said that when we die, we go into the religious imagination. And that is the same imagination that is the collective unconscious. And that's in art and poetry and so on. Jung said that the afterlife is the land of images, pure images that have free form and free ability to transform in front of our eyes. I'm more impressed with the likelihood that this is what awaits us. The unconscious behaves as if death does not exist. Even when someone knows they're dying and are in the last weeks of their life, their dreams show that death will happen, but it's not the end. It's as if it's a door that the person will, when they die, pass through. Yeah. And there's a whole other dimension there. We see this in the art, for example, of Bosch, where you see the tunnel that people who've had near-death experiences almost uniformly claim to experience. So that's consoling, the notion that we may survive our deaths. It's consoling. Yeah. Although I will point out it's also awesome in a way that can, the implications of which can be frightening, because contrary to everything we know about what an afterlife might be based on people who've had near-death experiences or based on active imaginations like the kind I describe in this book, the afterlife is not a place where you sit and are served by one of the Islamic visions of the afterlife is that you are served by something like 72 houris, who are these beautiful young maidens who come and they will serve you a pineapple daiquiri and so on while you're sitting in the sun and relaxing.
Yeah.
On the contrary, I think it was Noel Coward said this, that what makes us think that the afterlife is any less a place of work and responsibility than this life? Mm-hmm. It may very well be a place where we have to work more on ourselves, because there's virtually, the reports of people suggest, nothing really else to do except to individuate, to develop our consciousness further, to learn how to love others as well as ourselves deeply, not narcissistically, but deeply. Some of the dreams I've had of people who were in my life suggest that they are working on the other side the same way we are working on this side. So, for example, I once said, it's not in the book, but it's not unlike what happens in the book. I had a dream some years ago about a year or so after Edward Edinger died. And the dream takes place in a diner, you know, like one of these 1950 diners, like Johnny's, which is still around and has that 50s decor.
Johnny Rockets. Yeah.
Edinger, who is a pretty stoic man, is sitting at a table in this morning. This cafe, he's sitting there in the morning and having breakfast, and I see him and I come up and he welcomes me and I sit down, And at the time I was writing the book on American culture, the America's Identity Crisis, previously, yeah. State of America. And I figured, well, he's a great guy to ask about this book because he is very interested in the connection of the collective unconscious with the American psyche. And I'm about to ask him about that, and he interrupts me, and he says, guess what I'm doing on the other side here? And I say, what are you doing? And he says, well, I'm writing a book about, and then he tells me about the book he's writing. So to abbreviate that and not get into all of that, but it suggests that people work on the same things on the other side that they work on this side, huh. But perhaps unimpeded by a lot of the earthly trappings that impede us, like the body and, you know, having to earn a living and pay taxes and raise your children. It's a different focus. Now, this is maybe the psychological and spiritual equivalent of what physicists call parallel universes. It seems that their physics and depth psychology might converge.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I was raised in the Christian tradition, and the idea of, but as an adult, when I've reflected on the idea of heaven, I mean, it just sounds so boring. I mean,
how many strawberry daiquiris can you drink?
Yeah, you know, boredom would be the worst, and so we would hope that there'd be something to keep drawing us forward. That really makes sense, what you're saying. You know, you prefaced everything that you just said with when I wrote the book, and I thought, oh, you should say when we wrote the book.
Right. Right. The I or the ego in active imagination is more like a secretary than an author.
Yeah.
He or she is just...
Yeah, this touches on so many other phenomena. For example, automatic writing, which, you know, some people have the experience of their hand is just moving and or it's being dictated to them. And there have been books of purported wisdom. I've never read those books. The skeptic in me does not want to read those books, resists it. But I have it on good authority that there's a lot of wisdom in those books.
All those phenomena seem to tie in and tie together in the unconscious. You know, the unconscious is a psychological term simply for the unknown.
Once
it becomes conscious, or elements of the unconscious, because that's an infinite part of our psyche in terms of the imagery and the archetypes that are there. But once we become conscious of them, the unknown value or meaning that these unconscious phenomena or characters in our psyches carry becomes knowable. You know, all these authors of active imagination classics in our literature are basically setting out to explore the unknown, and it comes up in this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this dialogue
with
the wisdom hidden within us that seems to precede us and doesn't seem to come from our egos.
Now, one of the topics that you take on is the evolution of consciousness, and that you develop a new understanding of human evolution. Is that something you can take us through here?
Well, the concept of evolution that most of us have is what science has established as being probably correct. And that is Darwin's phenomenal contribution of the evolution of different species and how that evolution is dependent on certain principles such as survival of the fittest. It's one model of evolution, but there are other models and more than just a few. and there were competitors that lived in Darwin's Day that, in fact, the Darwinian idea of evolution was also discovered by another scientist at the same time, and there's always been debate about who discovered it first.
Yeah, I've heard that.
But the kind of evolution I'm interested in here is the evolution of the species and of ourselves as individuals in terms of our consciousness. It is about the evolution of consciousness. And that is a profound mystery that science has barely lifted the lid off of. We know that there is a relationship between the brain and the psyche, but we don't really exactly know how that connection exists and what it is that gives rise to consciousness. The Darwinian idea of the evolution of consciousness is that consciousness or the psyche evolves out of the brain, and it is an adaptation that the brain undertakes in order to advance the species and to secure its own continuity. So a human who is aware, who has sentience and consciousness, has a much better chance of surviving than a beautiful flower, which doesn't, as far as we know, have that kind of consciousness. Luther Burbank would say that flowers and plants do have consciousness, and often we experience a kind of presence when we're in the forest that might be emanating from the forest itself, all the trees and so forth. But the model, the Darwinian model, really looks at consciousness as the byproduct, as the fruit of the brain. That's a theory. We don't know very much about consciousness. We don't know how, if the Darwinian view is right, how does matter, which starts off inert and then eventually becomes active and then eventually becomes organic, and then you get species like mammals and the higher primates like us and our cousins, the apes, they have a consciousness that's very, very discerning. With most mammals, it's on an emotional and survival-oriented level, but it's still a kind of consciousness. We love our dogs because they look into our eyes and we look into theirs and we know there's a being in there.
Yeah.
We don't know how the brain and what was originally inert matter, the stuff that came out of the Big Bang and formed the planets and the galaxies, how on this planet that evolved into consciousness. It raises the question of, can something more differentiated, more advanced than matter itself come out of matter, unless it was inherently in matter to begin with and comes out later? So that's another angle on it, and I'm not the one who invented that. I'm just synopsizing it. There's other people who've talked about it. Nobody has yet been able to reproduce consciousness in a laboratory, and all this stuff in our media about artificial intelligence and robots and so on. Well, they do have artificial intelligence, but do they have real, not artificial, consciousness? And that is so far off of us being able to understand it, much less create it, that we just have to bow to the mystery of that while we are at the same time with an open eye and a discerning mind exploring it.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned flowers and trees, and I've been interested to learn about some of the science and the ways people are beginning to see the world in different terms, in terms of connectedness, which is a big spiritual concept also, right? That all is one, that we're all connected, and we're beginning to see situations where the flowers and the trees seem to communicate with one another, and the moles that, you know, that can extend for great distances beneath the surface of the of the you know, beneath the surface that seem to accomplish incredible things. And I recently was at attended a virtual dream conference, the International Association for the Study of Dreams, and it was virtual. It was a lot better than I was anticipating, the sessions that I sat in on. It was a fellow who's made a film that was astounding. He had quit being a professor and dropped out because he found it too limiting, and really gave himself up to nature and studying nature. And he described that when flocks of birds are flying together in formation, you know, we've always wondered, well, how does that work? It was his contention that they have sense organs in their feathers, in their wings, that are not only telling them, are not only detecting the lines, the Earth's magnetic lines of force, but also their proximity to other birds in the flock.
Right.
So there's just all these different levels that are, or the octopi, the octopuses, however you say it, who seem to have a very distributed brain, not just in their, what we would call their head, not just in the central place, but also in their arms, each of their arms, so that their intelligence and presumably their consciousness is distributed. So I think this is all really exciting.
It's very, very, very exciting. I've read some on this subject as well. It's quite fascinating. And even the insects who have a hive mentality are very, for what they do, very intelligent. Not only can they lift objects, of, you know, 20 times heavier than their own weight, but the way they communicate to each other and what their activities are, the entomologists are also, like these other scientists you mentioned, unearthing, no pun intended, wonderful mechanisms that really raises the question of the intelligence inherent, the consciousness inherent in and beyond the cosmos itself. The Darwinians and all scientists agree on this, that we don't need to have God, a belief in God in the picture of how evolution works, because we can observe a lot of it. You know, we can observe how the species evolved and one species turned into another. We humans ourselves have at the core of our brains what's called the reptilian core. It's the part of our brain that evolved at the same time the reptiles evolved. And it functions the same way. And even in its shape, if not its size, it resembles what is in the brain of a snake or an alligator. So all this is... it can occur on its own.
And it's no less miraculous, I think, than God, right?
That's right. It's very miraculous, and it doesn't need a God to explain its phenomena, its happenings, because we see it unfolding. Yeah. And God may or may not be present in that moment, but it seems to be happening in response to all the energy that all us creatures have, what Freud and Jung called the libido. But when you turn to the sophistication of all these creatures on our planet, it does raise the question of how does it go about giving the signal to begin with of evolving? Where does it originally come from? So the book very much explores that. It doesn't answer it once and for all, but it raises the question, and I try to shed some light on these things in light of our pistis, in light of our faith based on experience.
Who do you think your audience for this book is?
Well, I hope everyone.
Right.
I think it would appeal to anybody interested in the evolution of consciousness and of our species and of our planet, particularly at a time when our planet is endangered by all these threats, you know, global warming, overpopulation, the water levels in the ocean rising, the melting of the ice caps. Actually, the book talks quite a bit about that, as Richard is an evolutionary psychologist. And as he himself argues, he is an atheist, but he is also in his own way very spiritual, because he is in awe of the beauty and the profundity of nature, all the things we just talked about.
Yes.
So the topic of what we're going through with climate change and what the new administration is talking about with its tentative responses to that. People interested in our survival would be interested in the book. People who are interested in the workings of the psyche, such as the diverse people who populate our dreams and who are interested in active imagination and talking to these characters. I have a short appendix at the back of the book on how to do active imagination. It's not hard to do. It's a kind of meditation. It's very simple. And it's a direct contact to the unconscious. And as many people believed, that kind of visionary experience preceded dreams. In fact, I think it was T.S. Eliot said, our dreams suffer probably because we're out of touch with being able to access what they're about through visions, daily visions that we have while we're wide awake. Mm-hmm. So it seems that active imagination and visions preceded dreams and dream work way back in the history of evolution. So people who are interested in paranormal phenomena, the story is full of increasingly magical synchronicities and coincidences that happened to Richard, all of them based on experiences in my own life. I think that would interest those folks. And those who are interested in wisdom literature, you know, even the modern literature, there's a lot of very wise books that every now and again come up and become very popular in culture because of their keen insight.
Yeah.
I hope the book addresses some of those issues for those readers as well.
Well, I think that your book, you've just basically described my audience. I think that anybody who's listening to this now and has maybe listened to more than one interview at Shrink Wrap Radio, you're probably a good candidate for this book. And so I'm happy to be able to endorse it and recommend it to you all. And Michael Gellert, I want to thank you for being my guest once again on Shrink Wrap Radio. Stimulating as always.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you for having me. And it's become a bit of a tradition that with each book I come on your show.
Yes, keep it up.
I'm very grateful for your hosting it.
Yeah, thank you.
As I'm sure all your audience members are.
Today's guest, Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, is no stranger to explorations of his own inner world. After all, he trained with a renowned Zen master in Japan for 2 years as a young man. He also studied to be a rabbi in college and, of course, went on to undergo a course of Jungian analysis on his way to becoming a Jungian analyst himself. Notwithstanding all this inner world preparation, he certainly was not prepared to learn about 15 years ago that he needed emergency brain surgery to treat an embolism that might burst, As jarring as that news was, he was also not prepared for the changes in consciousness that followed on the heels of his brain surgery. I'm imagining that the usual boundary between the conscious mind and the unconscious somehow became more porous, such that unconscious material became more available and showed up, sometimes perhaps unbidden. Such is the adventure of consciousness he takes us on in his recent book, Far From This Land, a memoir about evolution, love, and the afterlife. In our relatively brief interview, we were only able to touch on the outline of that journey. I urge you to go ahead and purchase the book if we manage to whet your appetite in this interview. You'll find much more detail in the book, not only about the autonomous figures with whom he dialogued and the wisdom they shared, but also how to practice the age-old technique of what Jung called active imagination. I was so struck by the book's very beginning, which immediately places us in a sort of Alice in Wonderland topsy-turvy world in which Gellert vividly experiences an alter ego, Richard, an atheistic professor of evolutionary psychology who has recently had brain surgery and decides to consult a Jungian analyst by the name of Michael Gellert, who he has heard is good with dreams. Wow, and from there we are off to the races. Gellert's experiences with these autonomous subpersonalities put me in mind of an earlier interview with another Jungian analyst, Jeffrey Raff, who back in Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 290 spoke about his own experiences around what he calls ally work, in which autonomous personalities are called forth to provide support. Gellert's book, Far From This Land, indeed ventures further into explorations of the evolution of consciousness and the very universe itself.
Oh, Dr. Dave, this is Dr. Marilyn Steele calling, and I want to thank you so much for your program and just give you a few words on why I have become a subscriber. I had such a marvelous interview with you several years ago, and you are just unique in your depth of questions and the quality of your presence and listening. And I know I was able to say things that don't normally occur to me that I was so glad I was able to say. So thank you for that and for the wonderful array of speakers and authors and teachers that you have on. I so enjoy many of them, especially on shamanism and the divine feminine and dreaming and the imaginal realms. I'm always inspired in terms of my creativity and just nourishment for my soul. So thank you for all the work that you do and the gifts that you are bringing to us all the time. Thank you, Dr. Dave. All right. All the best. Bye.
Thank you, Dr. Marilyn Steele. It just so happens that today's interview on active imagination will be right up your alley. So time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks go out to today's guest, Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, for sharing about his new book on active imagination after brain surgery, Far From This Land. Next week's interview will feature longtime clinical psychologist Hugh K. Marr discussing his book, A Clinician's Guide to Foundational Story Psychotherapy, which draws together a range of theories and models to examine the use of narrative psychotherapy in clinical practice. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.